This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. I want to let you know a little later on in this program, we will have some analysis and explanation about what happened in a Boone County courtroom late last night as it relates to executive orders issued by Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear during this pandemic. It does seek to block those executive orders that he has implemented since the beginning of this pandemic, all of them. So that's coming up in the second half hour of this program. But we start the weekly news review with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Max Lonberg and his reporting on recommendations to the Cincinnati Police Department and how the CPD handled them, as well as calls for a Northern Kentucky high school to change its mascot. Max, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, of course. And this watchdog group that we're talking about is the Cincinnati Citizen Complaint Authority. We've talked about that exhaustively on this program, particularly in the wake of the civil unrest that's taking place here in our community and across the country. But over the years, there have been some recommendations to the CPD about the way it goes about conducting its business. But your investigation in the Cincinnati Inquirer reveals we don't know exactly everything that the police department has done in response. So talk a little bit about what you found.
That's right. So it might be helpful for a quick primer on the Citizen Complaint Authority. They, under administrative code, have legal authority to examine complaints made by citizens against police in an effort to find patterns which thereby could help reduce those complaints. So as part of that work, they often will issue a recommendation, something that they have found has come up often in citizen complaints, something they think CPD should do differently. They've issued 101 recommendations since 2015. We don't know how many CPD has adopted. The city wouldn't say, CPD wouldn't say. We do know that CPD at least responded to 59 out of the 101 recommendations, but a response does not guarantee adoption. For example, there were 6 recommendations to update taser policy because it was unclear when an officer could use a taser, according to the Citizen Complaint Authority. But CPD Chief Elliot Isaac said in 2017 that he disagreed. Policy was clear. A couple months later, an officer tased an 11-year-old girl. And then a few months after that, CPD did, in fact, update its taser policy. But it raises the question, would an 11-year-old girl have been tased if CPD had listened initially to the CCA recommendation?
And we're talking with Max Lonberg, a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. And that was Officer Kevin Brown, who used a taser on that 11-year-old girl outside a Kroger store here in town. And according to reporting, that girl had taken some snacks, according to her mother. In addition to revisiting taser policies, whether it be before an incident like that involving an 11-year-old girl or after, which was the case here, what are some of the other recommendations that you reviewed, Max?
The recommendation type that that occurred the most was officer review or officer training. These occur when an officer engages in some sort of improper conduct that violates CPD's policy. For example, there was a case involving an officer, Timothy Lanter, who was found to have used racially insensitive language when he called a black man boy. This was corroborated by the victim and by an independent witness. So in that case, Citizen Complaint Authority recommended that CPD review Lanter's conduct. CPD did, to their credit, and ended up shifting Officer Lanter's position to one where that would minimize his contact with the public. But
that CPD, particular officer, I'm sorry to interrupt, yeah. Max, but that particular officer, Timothy Lanter, had faced 13 other allegations of what you report as discourtesy or harassment.
That's right. Yeah, he had faced a lot of similar complaints. And some of the officers that also appeared in this list had also faced complaints in the past from citizens. We identified 22 recommendations from the Citizen Complaint Authority to conduct an officer review or add additional training for an officer. We could only confirm that CPD responded to 6 of them. We don't know about the other 16.
Were you able to get any information about why this, what may be characterized as reluctance to embrace this change, or just hesitation, or just opposition?
That is a fine question. I would characterize it as reluctance. I mean, here's what I know. The mayor, John Cranley, told me transparency is vital to the Cincinnati Police Department, but frankly, on this issue, there's been a glaring lack of transparency. We don't have the answers to how this public agency has responded to the civilian oversight agency. Patrick Duhaney, the recently departed city manager, told me that a great many, quote, a great many recommendations had been adopted by CPD, but he didn't give an exact number. And the civilian oversight agency itself has criticized CPD. It said four times, including once this year in one of its investigation reports, that, quote, CPD does not collaborate with the Citizen Complaint Authority regularly regarding policy and training changes. So it's clearly an issue. We just really don't know why there's this reluctance to have transparency.
And again, we're talking with Max Lonberg, a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Max, is the current climate and the national conversation taking place in the wake of deadly police violence against civilians altering the approach of the department to some of these recommendations at all? Are you seeing any indication that there's more openness now due to the heightened awareness of everything?
You know, I can't speak for everything CPD has done. I've really focused on this issue, but my colleagues have reported on other issues. I will say that the citizen, when it comes to the Citizen Complaint Authority, the civilian oversight agency, the city council did pass additional funding for that agency for many years. They were understaffed. City code requires them to have 5 investigators, but they had fewer than that, as few as 2 in 2019. So in that sense, there has been some response to these protests. In terms of how CPD's relationship with the Citizen Complaint Authority, from my reporting, I don't see any progress in refining that relationship.
Let's talk about body-worn cameras, because there were recommendations related to this. They are becoming more universally used across police departments in the nation, and they are used within the Cincinnati Police Department, but there was a recommendation specifically from the Citizens Complaint Authority that plainclothes investigative police officers should be made to warn these cameras. What was the result of that recommendation?
The recommendation, as far as we can tell, has not been adopted. CPD has argued that plainclothes officers are considered undercover. However, the Citizen Complaint Authority has argued that this model policy, it's a body-worn camera model policy put out by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. That policy says that units that have plain clothes officers should be wearing body-worn cameras. But as far as we can tell, and again, there are a lot of mysteries in this because we don't have a lot of the information. As far as we can tell, that has not been adopted. Plain clothes officers in Cincinnati aren't wearing body-worn cameras.
Use of force is really the main catalyst for a lot of the unrest that we're seeing, a lot of the protests against the deaths of civilians at the hands of police. And the Cincinnati Police Department has an internal use of force review board. I understand there are some complaints from the Citizen Complaint Authority about this, as well as some recommendations.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. In a sense, the Citizen Complaint Authority was, for these recommendations, just asking CPD to follow its own procedure manual. The procedure manual calls for a use of force review of various incidents involving a use of force case. And according to the Citizen Complaint Authority, CPD has not been doing that. They say that they have an internal investigation section that does review incidents, questionable incidents. And they also cited the Citizen Complaint Authority investigation. But nonetheless, I believe this was the most frequent recommendation. It's occurred more than a dozen times over the years. And to its credit, CPD has said that it, after years of saying it disagrees, it said in 2020 that it does agree with the recommendation to more frequently enact the use of force board.
A lot of the use of force that prompts protest and criticism of police departments that engage in it lead to questions about de-escalation processes. And de-escalation was also raised by the Citizens Complaint Authority towards the Cincinnati Police Department, as well as issues of how to evaluate harassment issues. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. The newly elected chairman of the public board of the Citizen Complaint Authority, Mark Childers, he said that in some of these cases, a citizen will complain of discrimination, but those, and these are his kind of, I'm paraphrasing his words, those types of cases are difficult to prove because you have to show an officer what's in an officer's heart. He said that the Citizen Complaint Authority's issuing these recommendations for a harassment policy could better help address those types of complaints. Because right now, CPD does not have a harassment policy that outlines an officer's actions that could qualify as that type of offense. As far as we can tell, that is still true. Despite the recommendations, there is still no harassment policy. And the same is true for de-escalation. Some of these recommendations included kind of asking CPD to add training for certain officers in de-escalation, and to clarify their de-escalation policy, but that's one of those that we don't have an answer to how CPD responded to that.
Well, we'll continue to follow your reporting on that. We're talking with Max Lonberg of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Let's turn our attention to mascots now. All of us in the media recently talked about the Anderson High School mascot, the Redskins, which is now being phased out after complaints of racism. And in Boone County, there is there's an effort underway to remove the Rebels nickname. And this one's interesting, Max, because Rebels is often associated with the Confederacy, but there appears to be some gray area as to the origin of how Boone County High School adopted this mascot in the first place. Tell us a little bit about it.
Right. So the history goes, the Rebels mascot was adopted after the James Dean movie Rebel Without a Cause. I haven't seen the movie, but that's the history. And but nonetheless, despite the origin story, the mascot has been affiliated with Confederate imagery. The Mr. Rebel mascot was clad in a Confederate uniform. In decades ago, the mascot was photographed in front of the Confederate flag. So there's no question that there has been this affiliation with the Confederacy and this mascot through the years.
And so some of that imagery of Mr. Rebel, that's been phased out already, correct?
Correct. In 2017, that was phased out.
And you talked to someone who attended Boone County High School, Spencer Zimbrot, who was a member of what was then called the Rebel Brigade. And then some people learned that that name was also used by a hate group. So now they're using just the Marching Rebels as a descriptor for the marching band. And he's one of the people behind these calls to change the mascot altogether?
He is. Yeah, he and another former student, Molly Stevens, started a petition to change the mascot altogether. Their argument is, you can remove some of this Confederacy imagery, but the root connection is still there, and until you remove the mascot entirely, the community won't be welcoming to everyone.
You spoke with district spokesperson Barbara Brady of Boone County Schools. What did she have to say about this issue being raised now?
We did reach out to the district for a response. Barbara Brady said back by email that, in a reference to phasing out Mr. Rebel, she said the school has already addressed the mascot issue and said there would be no further comment on it.
So then what would be the ultimate goal here? If you can get all the signatures you want, but if there doesn't appear to be any appetite for action from the district, what is the goal of these organizers here?
The goal of the organizers is to adopt a new a new mascot right now, and a new mascot name or school nickname. Right now, it's still Rebels, and they want to see something totally new with no link, however tenuous, back to the Confederacy.
Well, we'll continue to follow that one as well. Max Lonberg from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The weekly news review continues now with Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman, who's got a new story out this morning looking at the farm, a Delhi banquet and buffet hall. And there's some politics going on there right now. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure indeed. Take us to the farm in Delhi. A lot of people know this as a buffet and banquet hall, but this is becoming political these days. What's going on out there?
Well, everything's pretty political these days. I guess we didn't have enough hot button issues out there. But yes, the abortion debate is coming to the west side of Cincinnati. The farm is a landmark banquet hall and buffet. They have a buffet there weekly. The owner, Dan Elsesser, he's a devout Christian, and he is inviting a longtime friend who is a nationally known anti-abortion activist, Randall Terry. He lives in Tennessee now, but for the last 40 years, he's had a pretty confrontational style protesting abortion clinics.
And you report that this confrontational style will arrive in Delhi Township in the form of a 37-foot-long bus festooned with pictures of fetuses, medieval and Renaissance pictures of King Herod slaughtering babies, and a scowling Joe Biden. There will also be a painting of a weeping Jesus holding an aborted baby.
Just to make sure that there is no confusion on where they stand on the issue, it's a vehicle not meant to blend in the traffic. Randall Terry is also going to give a sermon. And he's also got a band with his four sons that will be performing Christian rock there. Their name is Insurrecta Nex, I think it is. I don't speak Latin. But he's going to be holding this demonstration on Monday night. And then the next morning, he's going to go in front of St. Peter and Chains Cathedral downtown and try and pressure the Archbishop in Cincinnati to make a statement saying, basically, it's a sin for Catholics to vote for Joe Biden.
And this is just the start. So they're coming to the Cincinnati area for what you report will be a 12-state tour of, quote, swing states to rally Christians against Biden. Why was the local location chosen to kick this off? Do you know?
That's a good question. Randall Terry and Dan Elsesser, the owner of the farm, have known each other for three decades. They first met as supporters of a third-party candidate, which I don't remember this guy back in the day. I would have been young, but Howard Phillips, he was a third-party presidential candidate for the U.S. Taxpayer Party, which is now the Constitution Party, which is a party that's known for anti-abortion stances and very conservative. It's a conservative third party. They've known each other since then and stayed in touch. Evidently, Randall Terry called up Dan Elsesser and said, "Hey, I'm kicking off this tour looking for a place to start it." And Dan Elsesser said, "Hey, my banquet hall is available."
And Terry knows a thing or two about bus tours. He did the same thing in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. Is that right?
Yes. He actually, because his confrontational style led to a falling out with the organization that he founded, Operation Rescue, in the 70s. He was too confrontational for them. Terry went solo and is still traveling the country fighting the abortion issue.
Do you get any sense from the business owner of any long-term consequences that could extend beyond the presidential election. You know, I guess businesses are becoming somewhat more political in this age of COVID-19, taking some stances against government policies related to shutdowns and mitigation efforts against the virus. But is there any concern at all over at the farm about turning off potential customers in the future?
Not from the owner. In fact, he texted me this morning saying that he's also hiring additional security in case there are counter-protesters, but he's not worried about it at all. And his clientele, a lot of it is conservative, so I don't know. And he's clearly not worried about if this leads to a loss of business or not. So.
And we're talking with Scott Wortman, reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. We'll keep an eye on that situation as it kicks off on Monday. But let's talk about some of these mitigation efforts in our region. You did a little story about complaints about mask compliance and the lack thereof. Mm. You talked to some health departments in the region. As of the published date earlier this week, you hadn't heard from all the health departments. Has that changed?
Yeah, I've been hearing from more of them. They're getting dozens of complaints daily. By they being that we've got, I'd say about 8 or 9 health departments just in the greater Cincinnati area. So they're getting a steady stream of people that are calling in saying, "Hey, I was at this restaurant and the workers weren't wearing masks." One complaint in Hamilton County, someone called saying that their elderly parents have been invited to a wedding in Glendale where there'll be a bunch of people and they want the health department to stop it. But this has kind of put the health departments in a very awkward situation because as far as I can tell, no one really, other than telling businesses, "Hey, these are the rules," there really is no stick to the mask mandates. It's, they're hoping people are on their best behavior, basically. Health departments are used to enforcing violations against businesses, but not so much against like individuals. You know, they don't see themselves as like law enforcement writing tickets to people. And as of now, if you're not wearing a mask in a store, you're probably not going to get cited.
You know, when some of these mask mandates came down, we did hear from some law enforcement agencies. Some were polite in explaining that they're not the ones who will be enforcing these. Some were a little more blunt about it. I think the Butler County Sheriff, the Boone County Sheriff's Office all said, you know, this isn't for us to enforce. And it is on the shoulders of the health department. What happens when they follow up on these complaints? Do we know?
Well, they call businesses, and that's where the health departments seem to be at their most comfortable enforcing it against businesses. The stores and restaurants seem to be bearing the brunt of this. But if they get a complaint saying, like, for instance, there are people without masks at such and such a restaurant, they'll call the restaurant, explain the rules. The restaurant, in pretty much every case, and I'm just saying, right, it could be a store, it could be a grocer will say, "Okay, yeah, we'll comply," and that's usually where it ends. There really aren't, and I've not been able to find any citations written since July 9th when the governor signed the order. But the health commissioners in the area, like Gray Kessler in Hamilton County, they don't feel like enforcement is necessarily needed. He's out there, he said, and he sees a majority of people, 9 out of 10 people, wearing masks and taking the initiative. Now, you know, how long that'll last and whether, you know, that'll be enough, I guess, remains to be seen.
I want to share some of the findings that you reported on from Butler County's health department. According to their call log, Topgolf in Westchester was, quote, filled to capacity, according to an anonymous complaint. So that was somebody complaining about, I guess, more about social distancing. And, mm-hmm. quote, there was no attempt to make anyone wear a mask at a Home Depot in Westchester. You reported the health department received complaints of customers or employees not wearing masks in 6 different grocery stores. And then you also reported from the Butler County Health Department, another person complained truck drivers at a Westchester trucking company weren't wearing masks. So you see the variety of different industries that are being policed by citizens here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a wide range. Some of them are office settings, you know. One of them, I believe, was an electronics laboratory up there in Butler County. But it is a wide range. But it is just a matter of what are the consequences if people refuse? And that's still a gray area. And Cincinnati's really not the only one dealing with that issue. If you look across the country, law enforcement agencies are pretty much giving the same response to governors and counties that are trying to impose this. It's something a lot of regions are struggling with.
Well, regardless of the politics of the mitigation efforts, there is a designation on Hamilton County, as well as Claremont, Butler, Montgomery, and a lot of the more densely populated areas of Ohio, as well as some less populated areas, as the governor rolls out this evaluation method about how to handle the response based on the number of cases. What are Hamilton County leaders saying about the, quote, serious situation the county finds itself in?
Well, I mean, Denise Driehaus, the Hamilton County Commission president, said we were yesterday or 2 days ago that we're moving in the dangerous territory. And pretty much all they can do right now is just plea with people to wear masks. I mean, that's basically the extent of it. Right now, the ICU and hospital beds, the way I understand it, they're filling up, but they still have, they're not over capacity yet, but that is a big concern at this point. I don't remember the exact numbers, what the capacity is. It's like 80-some percent, I think, at this point it's filled up, the hospital bed capacity. I'll have to double-check that, though. But it's getting to the point where they're concerned that we might start seeing, you know, what we're seeing in other places like Florida and places like that where hospitals are overwhelmed.
Scott Wartman is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. We're always excited to have you on, Scott. Thanks for sharing some of your reporting with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we'll talk more about some of the mitigation efforts and the effort to mitigate those. A late-breaking decision late last night in Boone County related to the executive orders issued by Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. And we'll also look at dozens of international students stranded in northern Kentucky and an exploration of what makes the Cincinnati statue of William Howard Taft unique here when the Weekly News Review continues. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the Weekly News Review now with WKRC-TV reporter James Pilcher. James, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're here because I'm just dying to get an explanation on what happened late last night in Boone County Circuit Court as it relates to the Attorney General and some local attorneys' objective to stall or end some of these executive orders that came from Governor Andy Beshear as it relates to mitigating COVID-19. What happened?
About 2 months ago, a local lawyer representing the Florence Speedway, a restaurant in Grant County, and a Fort Wright daycare center filed suit saying the governor didn't follow proper legal procedure when he issued these orders. It put an undue burden, and it was, you know, arbitrary because some people were allowed to open up and some people weren't. So that case made its way up through the court system in Boone County. They filed it in Boone County. And about 2 weeks ago, or actually, yeah, it was late June, early July, the Attorney General joined the case and asked to be to make this a bigger deal than what it was for just the local situation. So he was allowed to enter. His name's Daniel Cameron. He was a Republican who won in the last election. He was allowed to argue against his own governor, saying, no, the governor didn't follow the right procedure. This is a legislative role, not an executive role. They didn't issue the orders correctly, and therefore all of the orders were incorrect. at the time, the judge issued an injunction just for those businesses, allowing them to reopen. So the Speedway was allowed to open at 50%. Some of the restrictions on the daycare were allowed. Well, the Attorney General, by entering the case, wanted to take it statewide. And yesterday, they had a 10-hour hearing in Boone County Court arguing those facts, whether or not the governor followed proper procedure, whether or not he, you know, had the right to issue these orders. And basically, at about 10:30 last night, the judge says, no, the governor can't do this. And we are still waiting for his written opinion on how far his injunction will now spread to all of the orders that Governor Beshear has previously instituted, including the statewide mask order, including social distancing in restaurants, including all the other things, including shutting down schools. All of those things are now up in the air. We have no idea how far the judge is going to go. I just interviewed the lawyer who represented the businesses here. He thinks the judge is going to go pretty far.
And that's what explains it. That's what, well, it does, certainly. And thank you for that. And that's what's so confusing about this, because we saw some victory laps being taken by those local attorneys, as well as the attorney general, in their explanations online and through interviews. But we haven't seen exactly what the judge is going to do. So that's what's seeming so unusual about this particular case, especially when the stakes are as high as they are. We're talking about governor's executive orders during an unprecedented pandemic.
Right. And the governor is still waiting to respond, not knowing how far it's going to go. So I'm still waiting to get word from the governor to see, you know, what their official response is going to be. I can guarantee you they're going to appeal this. It'll go to the Court of Appeals. It might get fast-tracked all the way to the Supreme Court of Kentucky to see how much he can or can't do. The previous orders he couldn't appeal, but these he can. So I'm sure he can't appeal, though, until that official opinion is entered into the record. So we're kind of sitting here waiting in limbo to see how far does it go, what does it affect, and then taking it from there, what's the next step for the governor's office.
And we're talking with James Pilcher, a reporter at WKRC-TV. And James, am I right to be somewhat confused about the messaging coming from the two different camps that are going up against the governor's orders here? You do have the local attorneys representing those businesses, the Florence Speedway, the daycare, the coffee shop restaurant in Grant County, and then you have the attorney general. So what we hear is the unconstitutionality of the orders from the local attorneys. Also, it seems that the attorney general isn't necessarily speaking out against the mitigation efforts as much as he is against the process.
Pretty much exactly right. And this, what's ironic about this is that Governor Beshear, before he became Governor Beshear, was the Attorney General. And he did this several times, these same kind of lawsuits and these same kinds of entering into existing lawsuits against the previous governor, Matt Bevin. Now, Beshear's a Democrat. Cameron is a Republican and a member of the Mitch McConnell camp. So we are now seeing this play out as a partisan issue as much as it is a legal issue. But you pretty much have it right in that the businesses are arguing, hey, you're picking on us unfairly while you're letting these other people open, and you know, you closed us down, you didn't close them down. And actually the health commissioner last night on the stand actually admitted that one of the orders about the Speedway, which didn't allow families to sit together, had no really basis in scientific fact. So there's some of that going on. But then again, like you said, there's the AG's office, which is saying, hey, you didn't follow the law here. There's laws to follow. There's regulatory process you can put in place using the health department that you didn't follow. We've seen some of these same arguments play out, not as stridently in the courts as we have in Ohio. And obviously the politics there led to the resignation of Dr. Amy Acton. But it hasn't reached the level of the lawsuits that Kentucky has.
I think that's what's going to be interesting to watch on the other side of this, if the plaintiffs are victorious against the governor, because if they win and there's a different method, if they go through the proper procedures that the attorney general sees as necessary, what would the attorney general's position then be on challenging the orders at that point? And you're going to be talking with Daniel Cameron later.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking to him later today, and you can watch that tonight. I'm going to be asking him about that. I'm also going to be asking about the optics of this. You know, I asked the lawyer today, and he said, well, look, I trust people to do the right thing more than I trust the government, and that's his take on it. But Cameron has come out and said, I'm not saying the masks are bad. I'm not saying you shouldn't wear a mask. He said that in a statement before. What I'm saying is that the way he ordered it, he doesn't have complete rights. Now, I'm not saying I agree or disagree with that, but, you know, and obviously the judge agrees with him that he doesn't have the governor doesn't have the right just to tell everybody what to do. And so we're seeing some of that also play out in Ohio and in Cincinnati when it comes to, like, the curfew order and some of the things that the mayor did there, that there have been lawsuits saying that the mayor tried to attach the curfew for the protests to his COVID emergency order when there are different things. So there's a lot of legality, and it's a Gordian knot to try to untie all this.
Totally is, whether it's constitutional or procedural, that seems to upset some people. We will just have to continue to follow this and see what happens throughout the day. This is
I can tell you as an interesting side note that the owner of the Florence Speedway has gotten a lot of attaboys, but he's gotten a lot of hate mail too.
That's what's going to be curious. You know, I'll be curious to hear what Daniel Cameron tells you about the optics question, because you noted that he's a protege of Mitch McConnell's office in the U.S. Senate, and Mitch McConnell has been pretty public in recent weeks about the importance of wearing masks and taking appropriate mitigation efforts. So he does seem to be in contrast with his former boss.
Right. Again, and I'm sure he's going to try and make it a split the hair and, like, I agree with the idea, it's the way they carried it out. Well, you know, you're basically throwing out what the governor tried to make everybody do, so it's going to be an interesting line he has to balance here.
James, tell us what's happening on the campus of Northern Kentucky University. I understand that there are about 60 international students stranded there.
Yeah, and they're primarily from either Nepal, Sub-Saharan Africa, or Vietnam, and NKU has done a lot of recruiting there recently. And so these kids can't get back home because either, A, their country won't let people back in, or our country won't let them travel there. So they're stuck, and they have no way to get home, and there's only so much the university can do to feed them. They're promised them one or two meals a day, but there's a program called the Fuel Program, which is being run on a charity basis through donors like Kroger and others, basically making free food available for anybody on campus who needs it. But the administrator of the program told me they've given out double the amount of food this year than they have in the years past.
Where are these students staying?
Some are on campus at Callaway Hall, and some are on nearby apartments. And most of them don't have transportation, so they're either relying on the bus or they're walking to the grocery store, and they're dealing with the same kind of shortages of things that the rest of us are, plus they don't have a lot of money. So, yeah, it's a bad situation. And until Wednesday, they were also on pins and needles as to whether or not they would even be able to go to school, because the Trump administration originally had said, if you're a foreign student, you cannot take all online classes. You have to take some in-person classes. Well, there are going to be colleges, including NKU possibly, that's all you can take. So they either had to transfer to another school, or they would do inline classes, or they'd have to go home, and their visas would be invalidated. Now, after a huge upcry by all the universities and the students, the Trump administration reversed itself on Wednesday on that ruling. So
what happens next for these students? Are they just going to be on campus until the next school year starts, however that may look?
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty much what's going to happen to them. And then maybe by then, some of the dining halls will be opened up just a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, they're kind of limited in what they can and can't do in terms of food. And it's not just food. It's toiletries. It's toilet paper. It's all the rest of the stuff that you and I take for granted that they don't have the access to like the rest of us.
We're talking with James Pilcher, reporter, WKRC-TV. James, earlier this week on this program, we did a segment about the shortage of affordable housing units in Hamilton County in Cincinnati. And we talked to a prospective tenant of a market rate housing unit who currently lives in subsidized housing and is looking to move into a different situation. It's having all kinds of problems. You are finding some of that as well in a story that you'll have coming out tonight. What can you give us in the form of a preview?
Yeah, well, as part of our childhood poverty project, I did a story about what we're calling the renter gap, and that is the gap in home ownership between African Americans and the white community. Nationally, it's hit an all-time low. It's lower now. Black home ownership is lower now than when it was in 1968 when discrimination was legal. So locally, in Cincinnati and Hamilton County, the rates are somewhat higher, and that's primarily because we have a higher concentration of African Americans. But still, only about 11% of the homes in Cincinnati are owned by black families that are owner-occupied. So, you know, those rates and how that ties to poverty is that poverty, home ownership is seen as probably one of the easiest ways out of poverty, because you lock in your expenses for 20 years instead of having to deal with rising rates and having to move a lot and the uncertainty around all that. If you have a home and you have a mortgage locked in for 20 years, it's the same price every month, right? So I talked to one realtor who also said, we just have a generational issue where we're not teaching kids in school about how to buy a home and how home ownership really works and how the finances of it work. So that's what the story is about tonight. There's some fascinating data that I was able to pull up from the Census Department, and we talked to one woman who has lived in an apartment or a house rental for 26 years, and she's done. She's going to try and buy a house in the next 3 months. Primarily, she lives in because she wants some room for her grandkids, but she also lives in an apartment complex, and she's actually somebody in the complex got COVID, and she's afraid of catching it, so she wants to get out of that situation too.
Well, we'll look forward to that reporting. James, thank you so much for sharing some analysis, and always a pleasure to have you. James Pilcher from WKRC-TV. Thanks.
Michael, thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. And now we're joined by our very own Bill Reinhart, WVXU host of All Things Considered, also the voice behind the new feature here, OK, I Wanna Know. Bill, thanks for coming on.
Good afternoon. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. You're looking at the back of my head. You're in a socially
yes.
distant studio, but I can see your reflection, so this is kind of fun. And this was a really cool feature. We'd been talking about this for several weeks. Your first one came out this week. We're going to play it in its entirety today, the first one that came out. But tell us what OK, I Wanna Know is.
Well, it's those little things, you know, you're heading to work or you're going about your daily business and you think, oh, you know, I always wonder about that, or why is that way? But it's not really, you know, a big deal. It's not earth-shattering. I have these all the time. It's like, why? What is that? Why is that the way it is? And I thought one day, you know, someone should look into, hey, you know, I know a reporter. And I put it off, thinking, you know, this is not big news. This is, you know, not world-changing. And then at one point I said, you know what? We need to do this. Why not? It'll be something fun. We were going to reveal them during the pandemic when everyone was staying at home. But, you know, it seemed a little frivolous. And there was lots of real news that we needed to focus on. So we put it off. This first one about the Taft statue, I actually did the reporting back in February. And it's just been sitting there collecting dust
then. It was worth the wait. And we've got about a minute before I need to roll that for our listeners to hear in case they missed it on Wednesday or online. What are some upcoming topics that we might hear from?
Oh, I'm not going to spill the beans.
Oh, come on.
No, okay. I can tell you there's a baseball-related one for next week.
All right.
And that's the only one I'm going to hint at. I can tell you my mother wrote in and said she wanted to know where the name Cincinnati came from.
Oh, and so you had to go on a wild goose chase for that, or was that easy?
No. You know, everyone around Cincinnati knows that.
Well, I think they know, like, the basis. Like, yeah. You can give a basic explanation of who the city's named for, but why?
I may do that sometime.
Yeah.
I've got a few good suggestions from listeners, and we will be taking more suggestions. So if you've got an idea, go to WVXU.org.
I've got a few ideas. Are you going to be covering just the city proper, or is it regional?
Oh, no, it's regional. It's okay.
Oh, wait, because
Ohio,
you spell it out.
Kentucky, Indiana, want to know.
How clever. Okay, I want to know. And don't forget to look at Bill Reinhart on Twitter for his Friday morning walks and his Ohio River updates. And online and on air, you will hear reports like this. Here's the first Okay, I Want to Know.
Walk around downtown Cincinnati and you'll find statues of three presidents, William Henry Harrison, James Garfield, and Abraham Lincoln. What you won't see is a statue honoring the one president who was actually born in Cincinnati. I'm WVXU's Bill Reinhart. There is a statue of William Howard Taft in Cincinnati, as historian Dan Hurley is quick to point out.
Most people don't know about the statue because it's tucked on the UC campus behind the current law school. But it's there. It's a substantial statue. Anything dealing with William Howard Taft has to be substantial. It's 8 feet tall.
However, this statue honors Taft as Supreme Court Justice, not President. Hurley says that's appropriate.
Taft always had wanted to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Taft served as Governor of the Philippines, Secretary of War, and after his time in the White House, Chief Justice. Blogger and historian Greg Hand says Taft doesn't get people excited like some other presidents.
Lincoln basically gave some speeches here. He lived here for a couple of weeks while he was working on a lawsuit. And we've got statues to Lincoln all over the place. Taft was, in many ways, important for this city and important for the country, but I don't think he's recognized the same way.
Hand notes those other presidents all died in office while Taft survived the job.
The martyrdom of Lincoln still resonates today. Although Garfield does not have the same sort of legacy, the outpouring of grief when he was assassinated really charged the city. They wanted to name everything for Garfield.
Hand says dying peacefully in your sleep removes some of the romance from a legacy. A dramatic death or not, Taft's efforts are seen today, locally and nationally. He pushed for the Supreme Court to have its own building. He merged two competing Cincinnati law schools, and he started the tradition of presidents throwing out the first pitch at baseball games. And prominently placed statue or not, Taft is still remembered in his hometown. Kerry Wood is Chief of Interpretation, Education, and Operations Ranger with the National Park Service. Taft's Mount Auburn House became a National Historic Site in 1964.
They honored him by, after later in life, you know, commemorating his birth and boyhood home here. A group of teachers first had the vision and want to save this old home.
Today, there's a local brewery that plays off Taft's name and image, a county government building on 9th Street, and William Howard Taft Road, which, Dan Hurley points out, ends near the site of the UC Law School.
He had graduated from the Cincinnati College of Law. Then when the University of Cincinnati is founded, he was appointed to the dean of the new law department, and then they merged the two schools.
And that's where the Chief Justice Taft statue is. Ranger Kerry Wood has a theory on why there isn't a President Taft statue.
He's a person that came at a time where statues had slowed down. I know in the 19th century, statues were big, you know, with him being a 20th century president.
Greg Hand agrees there aren't many representational statues erected in public parks anymore. He says if there's a list of who to honor with a statue, he thinks Taft would be on it.
The thing is, since he has gone to his reward, we've had quite a number of outstanding people in Cincinnati, and I think he'd have to fight himself into the top 10.
With Cincinnati and Hamilton County now a Democratic stronghold, Dan Hurley isn't sure the political climate is right for a Taft statue.
Who's going to lead that fight to bring a statue of a past Republican president, Supreme Court justice, to downtown Cincinnati?
There is another statue of Taft on public display, but it's in South Dakota. Rapid City has statues of all past presidents. The Taft figure is leaning forward, preparing to throw a baseball. Bill Reinhart, 91.7 WVXU.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.